Okay, thanks. Thanks for sticking around. I guess this kind of makes me like the Bernie Sanders of this session, or anyway. So you have to imagine that we have time-periodic boundary conditions. So what I'm going to be discussing about connects very much with Monday's talk, in particular Steve's talk, on simulations about the nature of the Hubbard model, and in this case, three-band Hubbard model looked at from the perspective of two exact techniques, determinant quantum Monte Carlo and density matrix normalization group. And the work has been done largely by Edwin Huang, who's here in the audience, who's been doing most of the work on quantum Monte Carlo. And DMRG was done by Hongxin Zheng, who was a postdoc here for several years before moving up to Stanford. So I think at this point, we don't need really much in the way of introduction. We could just dive right in and cut to the chase. The bottom line is, as has been pointed out, is that there are many candidate states which are maddeningly close to each other in energy, fractions or tenths or hundredths of the hopping T. And so this means that, in fact, small things can influence which direction we could swing, into which candidate ground state that there can be. And so here's the plot that you saw earlier, plots that you saw earlier in terms of the Simons collaboration on the benchmarking of various different methods on ground state energy, and particularly identifying at this 1/8 filling in the single band Hubbard model that vertical stripes went out over uniform D-wave superconductivity, for example. So what would be really great is to continue to try to benchmark not only the equal time quantities, but also try to get a sense of the dynamics or the excitation spectrum that are signatures of the underlying competition between different ground states. And so this is a large body of work. If your name's not up here, I apologize for forgetting about it. About something that has been known for a very long time is that many simulations, many DMRG in particular, has found the presence of stripes over a wide variety of conditions or a wide variety of numerical techniques, actually, in which the charge order and the spin order are simply related by a factor of two. But when we did quantum Monte Carlo or go off to finite temperatures and try to look for presence of stripes, we never found them. And instead, what we saw in dynamical cluster approaches to the Hubbard model was that instead there was a finite transition into a superconducting state, so no signature of stripe order. And so then what we would like to do then is if small things matter, that maybe cluster shape, cluster size, parameters of the model, of the Hamiltonian that we want to investigate become important. So the game plan was rather simple. What we wanted to do is take the same cluster, so we have to work with ladders in order to compare DMRG to quantum Monte Carlo, and just stick with some candidate set of parameters and explore the effect of cluster size, boundary conditions, parameter change, and see whether the physics that was coming out from the two different models was lined up. And if it was lined up, then we could start asking questions, for example, about dynamics or excitations, and if not, to uncover what the reason would be that they would have two different results. Okay, so that's the simplest part of the story, the goal of what we're trying to do. This is just a simple candidate parameter choice that we made in terms of the three-band Hubbard model. And you could ask, why on earth should we look at the three-band Hubbard model? Why not do single-band Hubbard model? And there are many good reasons for this. I'm interested in spectroscopy, so that tends to push me more to more complicated Hamiltonians. But the real issue is we wanted to be able to capture the difference in doping with electrons or doping in holes and understand, for example, formation of Zangreis singlets, for example, and the influence on stripe or superconducting order. So anyway, This candidate set, say U on the copper, or U on oxygen, and some parameters characterizing the hopping and so on. These are not unique. We can vary these and look at what we wind up getting. But we'd always like to stay within a realm that if we dope holes, they go on to oxygen, and if we put in electrons, they go on copper. So, and all of these parameters stay there. Okay. So, and that's what this plot is. This is a work that Steve and Doug did on the left-hand side on three-band Hubbard model, looking at the way in which doped carriers go in, changing the occupation of copper and of oxygen, and also what the moment squared does as a function of doping. And over on this side is quantum Monte Carlo, at least just for the whole concentration. And I should say, I should have said at the beginning, everything I'm doing is in whole language. So if you see a filling which is greater than one, that means you have excess holes, not excess electrons. And so this is just indicating that if we put in electrons, we're creating more configurations of 3d10, 2p6, and putting in holes, we're creating more configurations with 3d9, 2p5. If we had gotten this wrong, we would have stopped. So first then, DMRG, these are reproducing results that have been out in the literature for starting at half-filled doping. So these are four-leg ladders with different number of rungs, 8 to 30, 32. So you can see here you have a peak at pi pi, and as you make the cylinder longer, that peak grows up, comes up in intensity, indicating you have an antiferromagnet at half-filling. And then when you dope in holes, 1/8 holes, then instead of the peak at pi pi, it splits off 2π/8 on either side of pi pi, giving the modulation of spin characterizing stripes at 1/8 doping. So as I said, this has been done before. So then what we wanted to do is examine quantum Monte Carlo again, same cluster, same boundary conditions. Oh, first, the charge order. So this is then looking at the modulation of the charge density, again, DMRG on copper and on oxygen for different oxygen along X or oxygen along Y. And so the you see the modulation being factor 2 different in wavelength than the spin. And you see, in fact, that the modulation on copper is not very big, a percent or so modulation on copper, and about a 10% modulation on oxygen, but with primary weight of the ground state being on copper, most of the holes going on to oxygen. Okay, so here's the quantum Monte Carlo, and what I'm plotting here is half-filling. This is SISJ, so the spin-spin correlation function, measured from this point at the center of the cluster. And I'm only looking at copper. There's really not much moment on oxygen. So we can just focus on copper as shown with the color of these dots. And so what you see when you measure this is just plus minus, just an antiferromagnet with some finite correlation length, because we're at beta of 12 or inverse electron volts. It's very hot. So in order to visualize this, I wanted to look at, you know, a sublattice magnetization, which just takes this data and flips the color or the sign at every other site. So looking at this being all one color just means we have a overall antiferromagnet. And so then we dope in holes. I'll show both of them here. Small amount of holes, 4% doping, then you could see that it still locally looks like an antiferromagnet. The correlation length has shrunk a little bit, and the decay you can see in the sublattice magnetization still looks pretty much like antiferromagnetic correlations. And then doping further at 8.7%, then you can see up here a little that you have a shorter length in this domain, but you can see by the signs here that something has flipped. And the way that you'd see it if you saw my laptop, which is much better color than up here, is that these all are antiferromagnetic domains as well, separated by that antiferromagnetic domain by a pi phase shift. So and the period, if you just did simple counting for half-filled stripes, that period should be roughly period 6 or six of these, six of those runs, which is approximately okay. So then if you continue to dope, so 1/8 doping, up here you can see the correlation, the antiferromagnetic domain shrinks, but you can see clearly a presence here of another antiferromagnetic domain with the pi phase shift, with the boundary roughly between rung 2 and 3 here, which has some fluctuation at the boundary. So that's 1/8 doping, but it's not particular to 1/8 doping. If you continue 1/6 doping, this would be period 3. So you can see more clearly that you have another antiferromagnetic domain here with a pi phase shift on this domain. And it really, you can continue going on, about 21% still present, these stripe correlations. And it's really only out to large doping at 25% that it starts to fractionalize or starts to get mixed. So just want to emphasize this is large temperature, but we're still able to see this presence of the stripe ordering. This is what John spilled the beans with earlier in his talk. So again, is this robust? Is this just something that was an accident in terms of cluster parameters and so on? So and effective temperature. So here are different temperatures. This is all at 1/8 doping. Now we've added some green lines in here to indicate where the domains are where the pi phase shift occurs. And so you can see this is lowest temperature. The domains are fairly well identified. And then you go up beta of 8, that's higher temperature, beta of 4. This is the temperature scale roughly of about J. And then as you go at beta of 4 or beta over 2, you lose the stripes.
These are different doping?
Same doping, just different temperature.
What's vertical? Different
doping. I'm sorry. Yeah. This is same different temperature, and across here are the same dopings. So that's half filling, 4%, 8%, 12, and so on. I'm sorry. Yeah. So the wavelength roughly remains about the same until the stripes disappear once you hit a temperature scale of roughly J or J over 2. Okay. Then here is different parameter choices. This is again at 1/8 filling at the lowest temperature, beta of 12. That's the reference plot of SISJ. Star, the sublattice magnetization. Remember, we did U of 6, here's U of 5, UD of 8.5, adding interaction on the oxygen, UPP of 2, making that bigger, UPP of 4, changing the charge transfer energy, 3.5 volts to 2.5 volts from 3 volts, changing the oxygen-oxygen hopping. And there may be some subtle differences, but at least to the eye, the presence of these stripes seems to be relatively robust, doesn't change in terms of at least these range of parameter choices. Of course, if we flip things so that we put holes on copper and so on, then that would change. But at least within this domain, the stripes seem to be robust to that parameter choice, parameter choices. And so that's then plotted all over here. So then we can look at spatial dimensions. So stretch the cylinder, which is here. So still four-leg ladder, but just make the cylinder or the cluster longer. Because the stripe order is not long range, essentially nothing really happens to the order from this reference point. It still remains the same. And then as you go longer, you start to see another domain barely being able to kick in, but it doesn't change the overall presence of the stripe order. And then this is taking the same length, 16 sites on the, or runs on the ladder, and just increasing the transverse dimension by adding two more legs, so 6 by 16. And again, the wavelength doesn't change really that much. You see the antiphase domains with the pi phase shift pretty clearly, but then we start to see something which maybe is happening at the edges here, and I think this gives us a clue of why we missed this in quantum Monte Carlo before. So if we just go back then to square clusters, this is what we did for a long time. or Betts, work on Betts clusters. And we looked at, do the same thing again. So started half filling, this is the sublattice magnetization. So at half filling, it is 8x8 cluster, half filling, it's an antiferromagnet. And then if you dope, well, first with electrons, okay, it's still an antiferromagnet, that's what we, early antiferromagnetic correlations, what we knew, reflecting the particle-hole asymmetry. And then if you dope with holes at 1/8 doping, okay, I think we looked at this before and said, okay, it's just a shorter wavelength of the antiferromagnet. But you could see up in the corners here, right, that there is another antiferromagnet with a flipped domain that's appearing at the corners. Now, we normally would forget, like Feynman told us, to forget your last data points as not being that important. But so first of all, why would we, what is this telling us? And I think now we can convince ourselves that really this is just the presence of these bistripes, a stripe going along one direction, going along the other direction, which should give this diamond-like shape with the change of sign as you go off into the corners. And then once you know or have an idea that something may be lurking there, you can go look and go to larger clusters. So here's a 10x10. Again at 1/8 filling, and now you can see this much more clearly that in fact there is a signature of stripes even in square geometries that don't break C4. Okay? And so then if we look at the charge channel and see whether or not we have modulation of the charge density, this is just replotting DMRG all on one plot of the copper variation, the oxygen's variation, with a clear modulation identifying charge density. But for quantum Monte Carlo, these are now open boundary conditions, so you have some variation at the end, but interior, you don't see any sign of modulation of charge order within the cylinder. So it's a good question of why that is. We're very hot. It's a small modulation to begin with. Maybe it is underlying, it is there, but we just can't see it because of the temperature. But the spin is fairly clear. Okay, and so another way to think about this, are these stripes pinned or are they fluctuating? And so we can look at this by looking at opening up the cluster, so have open boundary conditions here. And I'm gonna compare, again, SISJ star, from DMRG on the bottom here and quantum Monte Carlo on the top, zero temperature and 12 inverse electron volts for beta, and then just move the origin from the edge all the way down to the other edge. And so if you just look up at the top row, what you see is that stripe pattern runs with the origin. So I could go all the way down to the end of the ladder or all the way back and the stripe pattern just continues, meaning it's not pinned. If you look at DMRG, let's go back here, you see you have a domain here between rung 2 and 3, 6 and 7, 10 and 11, 14 and 15. And as I move that origin through those domains, the color will flip. But you see the domains don't really move. They stay pinned at the same spot between 2 and 3, 6 and 7, et cetera, indicating that the stripes are pinned at zero temperature and fluctuating at the temperatures that we could access with quantum Monte Carlo. And so, excuse me, gotta go to the end. Okay, so the bottom line then is this picture. Now green lines have been put on there as to indicate where those domains are as you drag the origin through, or the reference point through, or down the length of the cylinder. It's clear. This one tracks, and this one, the boundaries made more or less pinned. and so that then tells us that, in fact, the physics from reveal both with the MRG and DQMC on three-band Hubbard are similar. It's not seeing something that's incredibly different at all. And that was one of the criteria that if that were the case, now maybe we could ask something about excitations and things that we could check besides looking at equal time quantities. And so because we're interested in this magnetic modulation or spin modulation, then we could take target at looking at the development of the hourglass, or measuring S of Q and omega from the simulations. We have to wick rotate onto the real axis that we do with maximum entropy. I can tell you about that in detail. But what I'm going to show you then is S of Q and omega. So that's what's plotted here. Again, at lowest temperatures, the filling is up at the top left. So this is half filling. This is mega in units of J. This is right around pi pi. So this is a very broad or a very bright peak at pi pi, reflecting the antiferromagnetic order. And these green dots are just taking peaks off of an EDC, just taking a cut and dropping a peak at the top. So if you dope, I'll run through this quickly. You can first look here at pi pi. As you dope, you see pi pi just rises up, hardens in energy, and the intensity comes down. I mean, this little gap is reflected the finite cluster size that we have. That's not unexpected. You're just losing the antiferromagnetic correlations. If you look out towards the antiferromagnetic zone boundary, you see that guy doesn't really move, doesn't really change very much with doping, even out to 20-21% or so, which is one of the things that was a surprise coming from Rick's measurements, which have been looking at this. And then to see this incipient stripe, you look at this wave vector, which is at 2 pi over 8 split off of pi pi, and what you see from half filling when you dope is first it comes down, 4% doping, 8% doping comes down a little bit more, then it stops at 1/8 doping, and then it gets dragged up, comes back up, hardens again as the pi pi part comes up. So that wave vector acts non-monotonically, that energy comes down and has a minimum at around 1/8 doping, even though there's nothing special in SISJ at around 1/8 doping. And as I mentioned, relative doping independence of the zone boundary magnons or power magnons, and just the loss of antiferromagnetic correlations at pi pi, and hardening to higher energies. And so this is older data from neutron scattering reflecting that loss of intensity and running out to higher energies at pi pi. And this is the relative immunity of the magnon dispersion going out to the zone boundary from Rick's. And with Doug, we wrote a little paper about some implications of what that means, both of them mean in terms of superconductivity. So we can look at the data another way, which is instead of taking EDC cuts and picking the peak position off to get at the influence of the stripe ordering, we can look at MDC, taking cuts at fixed energy and looking at the cuts of momentum. So that's half filling up here, so it's just peaked at pi pi with very strong intensity. This is omega equals zero. And then as you dope, that peak comes down in intensity and eventually it splits out into two peaks as you further dope. And so you can then, it's very broad, but you can try to fit that with two peaks asymmetrically placed at plus or minus incommensurability around pi pi and plot those positions. And so then when you do that, you get two different lines, which are the green lines from doing the EDC, just measuring the top of the intensity in energy, and then the yellow lines are what you get if you just are picking off the peaks from the MDC, from this fit. So our peaks are relatively fat. Again, we're at high temperature. That's why EDC and MDC don't necessarily line up. But and there's nothing that's been done. I mean, this is scaled in terms of J, the parameters of the Hubbard model, which gives something which is reminiscent of at least a stretched hourglass or something in which these low energy excitations are really reflecting that drive towards having stripe order. And so we could look at that incommensurability by taking half of that distance between those peaks, either from MDC or for EDC, and you could put them on a plot, which is plotted here. So that's the distance the wave vector is away from pi pi, plotted versus doping. And whether we look at this in momentum space from the calculations that's in red triangles, or in real space from SISJ and drawing those green lines, those are the red circles, that we kind of are right in between this boundary of having half-filled stripes or filled stripes. And there's some variation, again, because the peaks are relatively fat. I don't know if there's a tendency there to drive, say, starting from half-filled and going to filled, or hugging one of the lines or not. I don't think we have the accuracy to say that from the simulation, but at least in terms of some of the data, we seem to be in between these two limits of Hartree-Fock stripes or strong coupling insulating stripes. So I think then you could ask, okay, what was so special about three band? What about single band? Do you see the same thing in single band Hubbard? So this is a ton of data, but it's the same data or same set of plots I showed you before. I'm gonna finish early. which is, this is single band Hubbard, where you're looking at U of six, a little bit of T prime added, about the lowest temperature that we could get to. Again, plotting the sublattice magnetization here, that's half filling, 4%, 8%, and so on, that you can see, again, we have that same type of stripe order that are appearing even at these high temperatures that seem to follow the somewhere between half filled and filled stripes. Again, if we compare DMRG and the quantum Monte Carlo with the open boundaries and run this, the reference point down the center, DMRG, the stripes are pinned, and in quantum Monte Carlo, they're fluctuating. The domain runs down the ladder. And then you get similar type of, and then again, a temperature, once you get to a temperature scale of roughly J, that's when you start to see the order appear. And then you get very similar magnon dispersion, at least the qualitatively around pi-pi, a little less so around the zone boundary. I think this is a difference between being less in the Heisenberg limit when we go to three band, but more importantly that you have, again, this non-monotonic dependence of the magnon or paramagnon energy at the wave vector corresponding to the stripe border. So that just brings me then to the summary. I mean, it was, as John pointed out, a surprise. We always thought that at these high temperatures, we would not be able to see this presence of or establishment of stripe order, but it's there. And this is what happens when you give a problem to a student who doesn't believe anything you said from history and decided to go after this problem with the amount of computing power that we have now to really push on the statistics to be able to see these sort of things, even when we're down of a fairly low value of the sign. So I'll stop here and thank you.
Thanks a lot. Of course, your lattice is very anisotropic, but for the excitation spectrum, have you tried to calculate on the diagonal in Q space?
Yeah.
So how does it look there?
I don't have any plots of that, but we have probably three or four papers that have addressed this. So what I tried to say is when you go to three-band Hubbard, J becomes a non-monic, has non-monic dependence on charge transfer. You're not out in the Heisenberg limit, which is delta of some large number. And that really controls the difference between the magnon dispersion along the pi-pi direction and along the pi-zero direction. In fact, in Heisenberg, they should be the same, say at pi over two and pi-zero. But as you bring the charge transfer down, then pi over two drops relative to pi-zero.
Tom, in the early at the beginning of your talk, you mentioned the three-band model has the advantage that you can look at the electron-doped material. As far as stripe is concerned, electron and hole-doped are very different. Have you looked at the electron-doped?
Yeah, we've not seen striping in electron-doped at the temperatures that we've been able to access.
Very nice.
So Tom, if you mentioned that right, the single band also has stripe state. So, is it possible to do a more, let's say, systematic understanding of what are the what is the role of the oxygen degrees of freedom? Is it possible to kind of turn them down in your three band simulation to see, for example, what happens to the onset temperature stripes happen or so on? Or is this harder?
So by increasing the charge transfer, I can remove them out of the problem.
That's right.
And so the scale, though, is going to be affected by doing that, and that's the real relevant scale at which stripe ordering is seen.
So you're saying that T-star over J is going to be the same?
I haven't said anything about T-star.
Oh, T-star, my T-star that I have in mind is where you'll see the onset of stripe.
Let's
call it T whatever you want.
It's not T star. The downturn in the night shift happens, but that's at a different temperature than when
the onset temperature occurs. Of stripes. So you're saying that it always scales with J no matter what you say.
Okay, all right. I didn't want to show it, but I'll show it. Here. This is the night shift as a function of temperature, same cluster for different dopings. And that's the boundary of what you can see. So here's a temperature scale. So J is up here. In these units. So here's that downturn, and you see for the temperatures we can access, we could call that T star, and then it maybe moves in, and then we're too hot. We can't see it anymore. So this temperature scale is rocketing down, but the stripe ordering is still there, or the tendency to stripe ordering is still there.
Yeah, Tom. I was just coming to my mind when I was listening to it. Right, so you may remember that like 20 years ago or so, with a lot of small group of people, we were fooling around with sort of models of fluctuating stripes, right? It's a more rail that single holes are strongly frustrated, but when you put them on the line, they can nicely meander and so forth. And in the course of that, I kind of figured out a ploy, which is in a way dangerous, but at the end of the day, it was kind of amusing. And we call that Euclidean time movies. But the idea is you work in Euclidean space-time, right? And
right.
Then you just say, okay, I take the Euclidean time axis,
yeah. And
I promote that to the time of the movie,
right?
And of course, in the real interpretation, it means so much as you should put all these things in Queen's position. You look at time slices, and you just show one time slice after the next. Then you take your next Monte Carlo incarnation, how is it, right? And perhaps from that, right, you may see what the microscopic physics is.
Yeah.
I guess you can identify sort of first quantized holes and spins from your determinantal Monte Carlo.
Yeah, this definitely was one of the topics that came out of this conference, actually.
Oh, yeah, you thought about it. I can assure you we produced a movie that made it all the way up to Dutch national television, be it at, 4 p.m. in the afternoon or something.
Great, I'll give you all of the data. I'll get famous.
So, so maybe one question. So the stripe you are talking about here is in the magnetic sector. So I think you showed it in a density check sector. So what you see there, or is the temperature so high, there's no signal, or what is the concept?
That's correct. That's the difference between D-Emergy, which sees very clear charge density modulation, and the quantum Monte Carlo, which does not. Any space, real space, momentum space. Charge order is relatively smooth or missing.
Hi, Tom. Very nice results. You showed some results for beta of 12 for the three-band Hubbard model, which looks amazingly high. So if my understanding is correct, the additional two bands are mitigating the sign problem?
That's a very interesting point. one of the advantages, apparently, is that you can get to lower effective temperatures with respect to J between three-band and single-band. I mean, I have less, as a percentage of Hubbard-Sratanovich fields, I have less number of them that are correlated in three-band than in single-band. I'm not sure if I completely understand it, but empirically, that seems to be the case. Yeah.
Do you want to make any comments about superconducting correlations?
Crap, I was afraid you were going to say that. Okay, so where quantum Monte Carlo is too hot, okay? We can measure the superconducting correlations, delta I, delta J, and see how quickly they decay. In DMRG and in quantum Monte Carlo, they decay very quickly. But we can look at it did flash by, so I already showed it already. These are not new results. This is just looking at the so-called pairing vertex of looking at gamma PD bar for D-wave by looking at this correlation or expectation value. And so the fact that it's negative means it's going in the right direction to promote D-wave superconductivity. It's not yet hit one where it needs to be. And as you cool down in temperature, this gets more negative or bigger and more negative, but remains largest at half filling and then dives off at larger filling. What we have seen is, and we haven't combined them on a plot yet, is when you correlate with that with the night shift, this, that's all for temperatures in which you don't have a peak in the night shift. When you see this thing turn over and go down, then you see this start to come down or become less negative. And this is the same that Doug and Thomas Meyer saw in DCA, which will, you know, make a peak appear further out at a larger doping off of that filling. So even though we're still hot, we're still seeing a lot of the similar tendencies from lower temperature measurements.
As long as some of us, like Steve, are allowed to ask questions, I'll try one. Do you see any indication of circulating currents?
Uh-oh. I'm going to stand over here. No. Fair enough. I mean, we looked at again, a current correlator and see how it decays with distance. And for what we've done for three band, again, changing parameters for different charge transfer, oxygen hopping, you know, they're there, but they decay very quickly by the next bucket. Excuse me? Yeah, no, so UPD is just proliferates a bunch of Hubbard-Sratanovich fields, so we really didn't look at UPD. So Chandra, you can attack me for that one, too.
So, any other questions? Maybe everyone's eager to hear from Philip, holding their questions. So let's thank Tom once more.